Welcome back, everybody, to the Placeholder Podcast. It's Monday, December 19th, and I'm Kaylee Fretz, and I think this is the last episode we're going to make before we pop off for the holidays. So we made it extra, extra special today. We've got two new placeholders. Those of you who listened to last week's episode, you know that we had Rupert Guinness on last week. Rupert will be joining us again going forward. But we're going to mix it up a little bit today. And first and foremost, how do I describe you, Kate Wagner? What do I describe you as?
That's a really good question. So I am a writer, obviously, and I work in both architecture criticism and also as a cycling journalist. And so I've been working as a cycling journalist for, I don't know, this is my third year now. And I specialize mostly in Slovenian cycling.
That's an understatement, I would say. You might be the only English... No, you are the only English language cycling journalist who specializes in Slovenian cycling. But I'm sure that a lot of our listeners out there have read some of your pieces. I think the first big one that probably would have popped up on people's radar was the ginormous Primoz Roglic piece that you did. What was that, like a year ago now?
It was 2021.
2021 in Bicycling Magazine, which was a superb piece and put you on the radar of people who had not heard of you prior. I've been lucky enough to know you a little bit longer than that. And we've done, well, two Tours de France nearby each other. And yeah, I'm exceptionally pleased to have you on the podcast and hopefully doing some other stuff with us going forward. So welcome.
Thank you.
And second but not least... another name who will be familiar to those familiar with another particular website, which we do not name, Joe Laverick. Welcome again. I'm not really sure how to describe you either. about 6 months ago, I would have said, you know, aspiring pro or elite espoir or something like that. Where are you? What's going on right now with Joe?
Well, it's an honor to be on this podcast, considering I also don't have a job in 13 days. I currently, for the next 13 days, ride for Haga's Bowman Action. I've been there for 2 years, but now I don't know what I am. A writer, bike rider, bike racer. I don't know. We'll see. But a bit of everything.
I've always appreciated your bike riding, of course, but also your bike writing. We worked together previously. You've done some great stuff. You actually worked for both myself and Kate in the past, and we're pleased to have you on because, well, you're in Girona. I don't know if you're in Girona right now. I don't think you are, but you're generally in Girona, and you're tapped into the scene there, and you're tapped into the pro peloton, and I think that you're a useful voice on that front. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Dane and Dave, how are you two?
Good. We just is that our introduction right there?
That's
like,
yeah,
Kaylee,
that's
all come on. All right, it's only like two
you've had
weeks
like
in
four and... episodes already.
Oof. All right. I guess we'll just get used to that, Dave. That's us now.
Yep. It's bottom of the rung.
Bottom of the rung. I mean, you know,
we didn't get a role. Not least, which implies we are least. Is what I'm thinking here. Yeah, that's all. That's all. Mm. Yeah.
Of the four, I would say so.
Oh man.
Well, we got a lot to talk about today. I feel like we just talk about this every single week. It's almost the overarching theme of this podcast at this point. We're going to talk about Mark Cavendish and where he's going and what he's doing next year. Again, a topic discussed ad nauseum, but there is additional information since last time we chatted about it. Our good friend Chiro over at Gazzetta has some thoughts and some reporting that has been done. We're also going to get into... well, some best and worst of 2022, some hot takes for 2023, whatever we want for, well, Christmas or whatever holiday we're celebrating in the next couple of weeks. And finally, today's geek warning, we're going to be talking about internal routing on mountain bikes, which I expect will just be Dave and I at the end yelling into the void in anger. Mm. Right, Dave?
Mm-hmm. Monologue.
Yep. Let's get into it. But before we do... we have an advertisement today. Today, I would like to talk about water bottle. That's singular, without some vowels. Whether you're looking for a laugh or a splash of class, water bottle has you covered. Their unique sport bottles are sure to turn heads and make a statement. Plus, they use only the highest quality materials to keep your drinks fresh and cool. So check out water bottle. bottomofthereast.com. Get your hands on one of their bottles today. If you're on Instagram, give them a follow at Water Bottle. That's WATRBODL. Real thing against ease over at Water Bottle. They make some amazing stuff. If you've seen the Haterade bottles floating around, that is a Water Bottle bottle. Perfect. I don't know, stocking stuff or Christmas gift, whatever you're doing. If it's not too late at this point, I did ask our crew here to give the Water Bottle site a peruse and let me know what you think is your favorite. So we're going to start with Dave Rome. What's your favorite water bottle?
I didn't need to look at the site because a few months ago they released a bottle, the Not Quick bottle, which looks a lot like a Nesquik kind of logo, but of course has nothing to do with it for trademark and copyright reasons. Just complete coincidence, like everything sold at Aldi. I love that bottle. I try to order some. Being in the faraway land of Australia, unfortunately, the postage was a little bit prohibitive for me, but a big fan of that one.
Dane, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, it's a tie. I loved the Ultra Tired bottle, which looks very much like a Tide branding detergent. I'm also a big baseball fan, so Water Bottle's main logo, just in general, the Dodgers-looking Water Bottle logo.
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, if you get a gift card, it has the Water Bottle, and that looks like the Los Angeles Dodgers logo for the non-baseball fans out there, which I love.
Kate, I saw you perk up at the mention of Haterade. I'm assuming that's your favorite.
Yeah, I love the Haterade bottle. As a hater, I like to feel represented in my cycling choices.
That's a personal favorite of mine as well. I've had them for quite some time. Joe, do you have a favorite water bottle?
The mystery bottle, actually. Because it's always nice to never know what you're getting. And with a very good Christmas present for yourself.
There you go. If you don't want to buy a Christmas present for anybody else, but you do want to buy one for yourself, that is the way to go. So thanks to Water Bottle for being our very first sponsor. You're the best. And we hope that everybody out there heads over and buys a new water bottle. That'll be great. Let's get on with today's show. All right. Let's talk about Mark Cavendish. Now, for those who listened to last week's episode, you heard the little tidbit that, well, the team that was maybe hiring or maybe not or whatever, B&B Hotels was telling riders that he was going to retire and that this is part of the downfall of that team. It appears that Mark Cavendish is not retiring. Pete Kenick on a podcast last week said he's definitely going somewhere. I just can't say where. I don't know where. And then Chiro over at Gazzetta later in the week came up with the news that he was headed to, drumroll please, Astana. Dane, I believe we joked about this.
We did joke about it.
Did we not?
We did joke about it. Yeah. I think it seems like an obvious place on the one hand because, you know, they now have open spot with Miguel Angel Lopez no longer being a part of the team, but maybe less obvious considering the rest of the roster. But I guess it's, you know, if Vino wants something, he's going to get it. And apparently he wanted Mark Cavendish. At least that's what Chiro is reporting.
And Chiro, we should say, is Chiro Scondamiglio is well, I don't know, one of the finest cycling reporters in the land, often gets these sort of things quite early, has lots of contacts with agents and things like that. So of all the people to have reported this, he's a good one. He's a good one to think that it may actually be happening here. Joe, your thoughts on Cav fitting into Team Astana here?
Firstly, I think it's very nice how Dane said, if Fino wants something, he usually gets it. That was quite well put, or nicely put, given a certain situation. Honestly, I think it's a shame, which as a Brit, I want to see Cav break the record, but equally, Mark Cavendish at Astana, I didn't have it on my bingo card 6 months ago, 6 weeks ago, 6 days ago even, but it just seems a shame to see the greatest sprinter of all time on a team which has a gray reputation, to put it politely.
Yeah. And there's no lead out.
Yeah.
Right?
Does he need
a lead
out? Is he
bringing Case Bowl? Did I see that he's bringing Case Bowl rhythm?
Yeah. Apparently. With who knows?
My thought on this is not related to him signing with Astana, but just related to the build-up of all the rumors surrounding where he is and isn't going. And I am of the opinion that Cav for the last 3 months has been taking the piss. Just like, I think him and a few people decided, let's just have some fun with this. And like, obviously, you know, it's a PR game, but also I just think this is just his sense of humor. And I think he's probably loving the fact that like he's been rumored to be with 6 different teams, and he had a photo taken with, you know, the CEO of Factor, and he had, you know, he's been on training camps with all these other teams. I think it's all deliberate, and for him, it's probably just hilarious. And maybe the Astana thing is where he ends up and is true, but at the same time, I think just the lead up to this has been quite funny and also quite butchered in many ways. But yeah, I mean, he's earned us talking about it every single episode that this podcast has existed. So anyway, I guess it's done its job.
Yeah, it's like Kardashian-esque, you know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Starting a rumor mill, constantly going from place to place to place to place to place. It's like, okay, you know? But it always kind of made sense to me that he would go to some team that had like a Tour de France invite. Like, I was really skeptical of him going anywhere that wouldn't have that invite. And as far as his lead out, it's like, yeah, I don't know who is going to lead him out. Well, I think Joe maybe has something to say about that.
There's a handful of people. I mean, even if whether or not Case Bull goes to the team, there's plenty of power riders that could be a second, third, fourth, fifth guy. Maybe not the last man for a lead out, and maybe that's what Case Bull becomes. But the team has Samuele Battistella. They've got Lutsenko. They've got a lot of just power. Luis Leon Sanchez, Johnny Moscon. Like, these are power guys who could be fine, I think, in that role of 3-4. Yeah, maybe just not the last man.
Where did the human powered health rumor come from? Is what I want to know.
we hadn't really mentioned that yet, but that was the other one that was swirling around last week. He was tied directly to the North American continent. Is it continental or pro-continental?
Neither, because it's pro-team, Kaylee, and the UCI is very displeased that you have not learned their terminology yet.
I still live in pre-pandemic 2016-ish times. Anyway, it is a... I'm calling it a pro-continental team because that makes more sense. They are a second division team in North America. The women's team is quite good and has some decent results behind them. The men's team they have had some decent results in Europe. They've done some stints over there, and they have historically, this team's been around in some version for quite a long time. You know, over the years have dominated things like the American crit scene and things like that. When they focused on it, but it was a very weird team for Cav to be tied to, because they have zero guarantee of being at the Tour de France, and at this point, that's the entirety of Cav's, you know, purpose, right? Is to go to the Tour, and if he does not have that guaranteed slot, it would be a bit odd.
I mean, I think it also makes sense for Astana because, I mean, if you think about last season, what did they do? You know, they really weren't very visible in any respect. I mean, I honestly, like, there were so many races where I just, like, forgot they were even there. And it seems like almost all of the news related to them is negative. And so, especially if you're, like, coming off the heels of, like, a big scandal, I feel like, yeah, signing Mark Cavendish is, like, maybe a way to get people to talk about you that aren't like, okay, is their kit the same as last year's because they have no money, or like, are they just, you know, like all of these rumors that surround Astana and like their invisibility all of last year, it makes sense.
They also don't have a lot to lose, so I mean I agree, this is a really good signing if this happens. I mean, this hasn't officially been announced yet, but Chiro's pretty solid. What do they have to lose? They only really ever get bad press in the last year or so. And if any more bad press comes of it, well, it's not like that's a big change in the way things have been going for them lately. But maybe they break the Tour de France record with Mark Cavendish. So I think if you're Astana, go for it. And also, it's probably, and we've discussed this before, a pretty incentive-laden contract as opposed to something like where they're shelling out a ton of money right up front. It's more, we assume, we don't know this, but it's probably more something like, hey, if you go win a bunch of Tour stages, which will be beneficial for everybody, then maybe we'll pay you a lot of money.
Which works quite well for a team that was having trouble paying its riders two or three times over the last couple of years. Most recently, I believe at the beginning of 2022, that went a couple months without getting paid. I was just you know, giving the Astana race resume from last year a little peruse. They did win Clásica Jaén Paraíso Interior, with Lexi Lutsenko.
What is that?
I think that's their only, and I apologize. I really do apologize for my butchering of the pronunciation of that. Fourth at the Giro, fourth at the Vuelta with Nibali and Lopez. Eighth at the Tour de France with Alexei Lutsenko. So, like, they were around. They just weren't sort of really around. They weren't really, like, winning much of anything that anyone was paying attention to. So I agree that from their perspective, what's the downside, right? It's just from Cav's perspective, what's the downside? And which is exactly what we were kind of hinting at before, which is that, and Joe, you hit the nail on the head. It's not a team with the best reputation. You've got, a rider with quite a lot of cachet around himself right now. And does this harm it? I don't know.
It's Mark Cavendish. Mark Cavendish on Astana, as I said, nobody called it. I don't think Cav can't fall reputation wise.
He does have that, I think.
I don't think Astana's reputation can fall any more than it is at the minute. So
I think he's got a bit of Teflon going on where the Cav's done things we've seen on TV. We've watched him shout at people on TV multiple times, and we talk about it when it happens, and then nobody really seems to care that much in the fan base. So I think you're right. I don't know that it could really impact him all that much. For some reason people tend to just kind of forgive a lot of the things that he's, been shown on TV doing, and so I think he'll probably be fine, even if he's going to Astana, a pretty, unpopular team relative to other teams in the Pro Peloton.
From a purely sporting aspect, does he stand a chance of winning a Tour de France stage with that lead out? Just quick reminder, everybody, we're on a podcast. They can't see your face. We had two heads shook, and one head nodded. So, Joe, explain your shaken head.
I personally think that Cavendish is not the fastest sprinter in the world, but his ride at British National Champs this year showed he is still one of the best bike racers in the world. But also, it kind of be interesting to see Cav go to line with one other guy, with Vino in the car, and see how that goes out.
I like the multiple just slight nods to history. He is more likely to win with Astana than human-powered health.
Yeah, that's true.
I'd say that I definitely would not expect him to win four Tour de France stages, win a green jersey with Astana, but one stage? I mean, there's 21 to pick from and maybe seven sprinters days. Like, Mike Tunison won a bunch sprint a few years ago. Not that he's slow, but he's not the fastest guy in the bunch sprint. Maybe 99 times out of 100, maybe more like 9 times out of 10. He's not that slow. I think Cavendish could win one of seven sprint stages, maybe. Get just that one to break the record, I think, is absolutely possible. People crash all the time. Even if you have a great lead out, it doesn't guarantee that you win. We see that all the time. It's often the second best lead out, or the guy that gets on your wheel if you have the best lead out. And I think he's fully capable of that because he's a veteran sprinter who knows how to follow the wheels. So I don't think he's going to be dominating with the Astana lead out. Absolutely. He's going to miss Michael Morkau for sure. But maybe one stage is possible.
The other thing here is that Cavendish has the experience and the mindset potentially to Mighty Ducks, the Astana team, and to get them all together, right? Like to pull them together, to get them with the goal of a tour stage, right? And pull them in line, get them thinking like a lead out train.
So he's Emilio Estevez, in your analogy, he's giving court
order. It's been
ordered.
A long time since I've seen the movie. I just, I'm just, the reference probably wasn't great, but I think there's potential for him to pull something together and turn that team into what he needs out of them, especially if they're signing him with the goal of getting a tour stage.
Whole new lead out strategy. They're flying V. They're going to stick him in the middle and they're going to go all around him.
It suddenly crossed my mind.
So, I think it's a fantastic analogy.
It would definitely confuse the peloton.
It's an arrow shape.
It's what the geese do, right?
It's like it's a better analogy for cycling than baseball. I feel like that you could shoehorn this into cycling a little better than a lot of other sports. So,
yeah.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. I mean, an echelon is like half of a flying V.
Bingo.
That is
perfect.
That's very true. Very true. I'm still not completely discounting what Dave said earlier, which is that this is an elaborate plot to make cycling journalism look stupid. I'm not discounting that in any way. And I think like Pete Kennick, who's a pretty good friend of Cavs, could absolutely have been a plant in all of this. Like, that is entirely possible. But I at this point, I think it's more likely than not he ends up at Astana.
Can I just say one last thing on this? As a bike racer who doesn't see myself as a journalist, more as a writer, I would absolutely love it if Kav was just playing with all of you.
I'm okay with it. I mean, like, it's this or we talk about Val di Sole. Like, I'd rather talk about this than cross. So, fine with me.
I mean, he's been doing this to us for how many years?
That's a good point.
That's true. Yep. We deserve it. We fully deserve it. Let's be honest.
I applaud it.
Yeah. And so if it was truly like he mapped out this grand scheme to make us all look like dumbasses, then just kudos to the man at that point. But I do genuinely want to see him race next year. So I'm kind of hoping that something pops up. Anyway, speaking of fiery Brits, the new Ineos kit was dropped today. It is, well, as I put on my Instagram, I put the Ineos kit and a Bahrain Victorious kit, which are nearly identical, and then Guy Fieri from the Food Network, and they all have strikingly similar vibes that they're putting off. What do we think of the new Ineos kit, team?
It's not like a full thumbs down. Like I don't know. There's worse kits. Like it's not the worst kit I've ever seen. But given the budget of the team, they could have hired somebody with taste to do better.
I think the kit itself is fine. It's just the fact that it's a complete knockoff of the Bahrain Victorious kit, which is, of all the kits to knock off, I'm not sure that's the one I would have chosen.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Bahrain either, so.
Genuine question. Like, our kit designers people who follow pro cycling? Because if I was a team boss, I'd hire someone who's never seen the pro peloton before and just give them a brief.
I mean, that's how you end up with the, like, the Palace EF kit, right?
Dope.
Where you just hand, like, we need this design, or we need this shape filled out with whatever you want to put on it, and you end up with the Palace EF kit, which was sweet. Like, not to everybody's taste, obviously, a bit wild, but you know, those jerseys still show up on eBay and sell for a couple hundred dollars, so clearly they did something right over there.
A fire red is much more on brand for Ineos, though, isn't it, in terms of what was previously used? It's
just,
it does align
burning petroleum. What I don't understand is how does the UCI look at all these, like, that you have to get your kit approved by the UCI, right? You send your kit in, the UCI is like, yes, you have put the right logos on, you've got the things that are the right sizes, like they selected these things. What they don't appear to do is go, hello, your two kits are identical, Bahrain and Ineos. Can one of you please change them? And I still don't understand why they don't do that.
Well, they have like a critical mass that you have to reach, right? Because like the women's peloton had that last year, but it was like four or five teams. This is only two. That's fine, apparently.
And Kenny, there's a great assumption here that the UCI are actually doing their job.
Also true. I assume best intentions, Joe, until things suggest otherwise.
I think, speaking as a design critic, when you're talking about design in terms of like effectiveness, right? I mean, there's something to be said for like simplicity, legibility, and in terms it's a kit in motion, so like legibility in motion. You know, uniqueness, all of these things, you know, brand recognition, all of these things, certain teams just do better than others. Like EF is really good with brand recognition, for example. For simplicity, like it last year was pretty simple. It's like navy and their name is on it. I mean, kind of boring, but it.
Well, and the Ineos logo itself is this like sort of unholy amalgamation of every available font in Microsoft Word. And so I don't think that they were starting from a real.
Yeah. But what I don't understand
place.
Is about kit design is that aside from EF, it doesn't really move with the trends in design itself. Like in graphic design, I've never understood why kit designers, I mean, they must be just cycling people, because like actual graphic designers, they get way weirder than like kit designers do. I mean, I definitely think that like if you are a graphic designer working right now, you would be really into these kind of post-digital, weird, not quite vaporwave, but like very strange typefaces, weird, ironic minimalism and all kinds of other things going on in design. And like, for some reason, every cycling jersey of the 2020s looks like it would be a PowerPoint background from the 2010s.
Maybe they're just behind a little bit. So like in 10 years, you'll see that, but not yet. It could just be a delay.
Yeah, we were doing 90s revival in 2015. And like by the time it's 2025, they'll be doing 90s revival.
I just love that mental image of everyone just rolling around as a PowerPoint presentation.
Do we have any other new kits besides Astana's, which didn't
I'm trying to think.
FDJ's looks like PSG's from the football world.
Yeah, it does.
It's the exact same thing.
I'm sure Cycling News must have a kit thing, right? There we go. These are the 2023 team kits.
Thank you, Cycling News. Now I get bombarded with 50 ads.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're right. I didn't really make that connection, the PSG connection. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we got to talk about Soudal Quickstep, man. Yeah, this is a bad kit. I'm just going to say it. It's extremely crowded, but not in, like, the weird, almost, like, ironic 90s way, like, you know, Mercatone Uno or whatever. It's just crowded in a way that, like, you can tell everyone got into a boardroom. All of the sponsors got into a boardroom and yelled at each other until their logos were sufficiently big enough on Remco Evenepoel's sleeves. And, yeah, it just... go together. And if you're just doing something that does not go together, you really got to lean into the irony of it. And yeah. Also, it's just so bad.
I think I never really conceptualized this until you said this, but like, I'm willing to accept it when it's an Italian second division team. And I didn't really think about that until now. And now I'm like, you know what? You're right. If this were a second division team that I only see at the Giro, fine. But if it's Quickstep, you're right. It's too crowded. I like that.
I just like the pirate on the shoulder.
It's Napoleon. He's not a pirate.
Yeah. But he looks like a pirate. So, like, it says Napoleon underneath it. So clearly it's Napoleon, but it just looks like there's a pirate on his shoulder when you first glance at it. And the whole thing is kind of hideous. If we kind of scroll through, we're just looking at Cycling News' 2023 team kits as we talk about this. Joe, you mentioned previously that the Groupama FDJ is very PSG like, little soccer football influence. Trek is good as always. The UAE fade is still there. Not a whole lot else to be shocked about, I would say.
The new Israel Premier Tech jerseys all look like tampon boxes.
That's so true. I was about to say it looks really cool, and now I can't unsee that.
It's like one of the hip tampon brands, and it's like, yeah, we use all natural cotton, and it costs like $8 instead of like $6. Sorry, I'm bringing my feminine touch to the podcast.
That's why we invited you on, Kate.
Thank
it's
you.
Very important. Well, on that fantastic note, I think we should probably leave kits behind.
Yeah,
we got a fair amount else to talk about.
Yes, that's fine.
All right, so. Before we get into, we're gonna geek warning at the very end of the show today, where we talk about mountain bikes. We did want to, you know, it's the last show of 2022, and granted, this podcast is only 5 weeks old, so there's not a whole lot in the history of this podcast to talk about. However, we were all paying attention to cycling and the cycling world for the last year, and so wanted to kind of run around and, well, just get some responses to a couple basic questions. The first of which, best thing to happen in 2022. I'm going to start with Dave. What do you got, Dave?
I thought we were talking best moment, so I was going to go with Mahorik's San Remo. Mine's purely from the tech point of view, is taking some mountain bike tech and trying to utilize it for gain, and I just love how he has a history of pushing it sometimes too far on descents, and he was just looking to get that edge again, and so yeah, that stood out for me from a racing point of view. From a tech point of view, I don't know, nothing came to mind as far as something that was truly groundbreaking that really impressed me, so I'll stick with the racing note.
I mean, it could be the same thing. Dropper post used to good effect to win a monument.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
A pretty big one.
Yeah, and I think moving forward, like, there's been a bit of talk about how no one's followed him. He said, he previously quoted as saying he'd ruined road racing through that, and he hasn't. There's a lot of factors there that are going to stop droppers from becoming popular, namely weight and the fact that they don't fit any existing road frames. But yeah, I think since they got rid of the Superman position, there is an advantage there from an aerodynamic point of view. So yeah, I'm keen to see more of it, even though I don't think I will.
Can I just add on the Mohorovic topic? Because that was definitely my favorite racing moment of 2022. Because I always think of Mohorovic as like a kind of engineer. And I wrote this in my recap for Velo News about this race. Is that like, not only is he an engineer, and I've actually been to his house because I profiled him for Ruler, and I spent like all day at his house. And he has like a shed where he basically does his like experiments. Like he is like kind of a mad scientist with the tech stuff. But the other thing that really fascinates me about that race is the way that he socially engineered that race. He literally was like talking to guys before the race started, being like, don't follow me. Don't follow me. When I go on the descents, like, don't follow me. Something bad will happen to you. Like, he's like, don't mess with me. I'm insane.
Joe, have you ever tried this tactic?
I mean, no. I'm sure it got under a lot of people's skin. Yeah. And like, also to be fair, he was insane. There was like some moments of that descent where I was just like, he's going to die. He's just not afraid to die. I it's crazy.
If I remember correctly, didn't Pogačar, he was following him down the descent and was like, nah, no, actually, I value
my
life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Pogačar was literally like, no way.
Live to win another monument was Pogačar's plan. It worked, but not that day. Not that day.
Ah, that was a superb finale. I love MSR. Yeah. I know I've said this before, but it might be my favorite monument because the last 15 minutes, we don't need to get on that rabbit hole right now. We'll talk about it more in the springtime. I see Joe shaking his head, disagreeing with me, but we'll debate that in like March sometime. Joe, what was your favorite moment of 2022? Your favorite thing in 2022?
I was originally going to say, well, we've spoken about him enough, but Cavendish winning nationals, because just being in that race, I can't describe how crazy that day was weather-wise. He was in the first move and he raced it like a true bike race, which I don't think he's actually had to do that many times in his career. I'd say that's easily one of his top three wins ever. But then I was just sitting here when you were talking about the dropper post and I realized my favorite thing was Gravel Worlds may have been raced on road bikes.
That's actually a great one. Yeah, solid pick. Yeah, my favorite was all the brands promoting their gravel bikes prior to all their sponsored riders just riding their road bikes.
With like 32s on.
Yeah.
Oh, just fantastic. Kate, what's your favorite?
I said Mohorovic, but I guess I have to come up with another one.
We can move on to Dane.
Come back to me.
Yeah, you guys can.
Sorry, Kate.
The Mohorovic gets two votes already, which is going to be hard to overcome. Dane, what was your favorite?
It's tough to pick between the classics and the Giro, but I guess I'll go with Girmay at the Giro. I mean, either way, Binyam Girmay over the course of 2 months, probably. Winning a classic and then winning a Giro stage was thrilling. He did it in ways that were, I mean, any classic I tend to enjoy, so really anything can happen at a classic and I'll enjoy it. But he wins them in entertaining ways, beating Mathieu van der Poel to win a stage of the Giro. I don't think it gets any better than that. And the excitement around that, the joy that is experienced by Eritrean fans, I think that just, really took the cake from me on the year. Binyam Girmay winning two big races in style and getting just a bunch of different firsts on both occasions was, really great.
Yep.
Girmay at the Giro was mine, so there we go. We have two votes for Girmay at the Giro, two votes for Mohorovic at Milan San Remo, and one vote for Gravel Worlds on road bikes. What about your hottest take 2023? Now, these could be anything. These could be something you think will happen, some weird thing that will be said. I'm going to go backwards this time. Dane, what do you got?
I don't know. I feel like apparently it's a hot take that I think Cav's going to break that record because I think he can do it wherever he goes. I don't even know if I'm rooting for it to happen. I think he can do it. I think he can win a single stage. It's always required. And if he doesn't do it in a sprint, maybe he'll get into a breakaway on an echelon day. I think he can pull it off, and I don't think he needs to be on the best team. I don't think he needs to have the best lead out. I think just one's enough, and I think he can do it.
Kate?
Van Aert will win no classics this year.
Ho, ho. Why not?
I don't know. Maybe he's a climber now.
I like it.
I mean, it's just like, it's really great to have this kind of take because like it, when you're right, you're like, oh, but when you're wrong, it's like, yeah, I mean, come on. That's hot take.
That's basically all day long on ESPN2. It's just that. It's nobody will remember the bad, stupid things I say, but they'll remember if I say something tricky and smart. So,
like theoretically, though, like I feel like Yumbo right now has just too many cooks in the kitchen. People were like, yeah, it worked for the tour, right? But it like kind of didn't work for the tour in a way that, like, you know, look at Roglic now, right? He's just basically sidelined. And, you know, he had this crash at the Vuelta. He's clearly, like, kind of maybe not in a great place. But with, you know, the whole Fred Wright thing and everything like that, just, like, he's not – I don't necessarily think he's taking it that well. Maybe that's just me projecting on him. But, like, I don't think you can say, like, yeah, we came with two leaders to some big event and then just, like, it's obvious that it's only going to be one afterwards. And it's like, yeah, but, yeah, it does work. Technically, it works. But when it comes to like a personnel level, those things I think build resentment over time. It's kind of like, you know, Magic John or Shaq and Penny Hardaway on the Magic. You know, they just couldn't beat both of them. And I feel like with Van Barle and with Van Aert both like competing for the same races, like, I don't know, it just kind of feels. Yeah, who knows? We'll see.
I feel like Van Barle could benefit from that in the same way that like Nicky Terpstra benefited from being on Tom Boonen's team. I think that could be maybe the only way that it kind of works itself out, where everyone just watching WOT the entire time. I think that's a decent take there. Joe, what do you got?
Kind of the geeky TT one is that the new UCI TT rules will actually have a bigger impact than people think, because the UCI rules are now changed towards a rider's height rather than the hard. If you measure 190 once in your life, you then get this magical extension. And then my Hail Mary is that Ganna's gonna win Milan San Remo.
Oh, I love that. And I agree with the TT thing. I think that's it kind of underestimated what that's gonna do and how many more riders are gonna be significantly more aero than they were before.
But it'll take time, right? Like those regulations will take time to figure out those benefits and to spend time in the wind tunnel and then to train around them. To condition the riders to maximize. So I don't know if we'll. I think it probably could happen in the off season for people really going after it. But I think it'll probably be more seen in 2-3 years from now.
Based on what we've heard, maybe Mahorch is already really in his shed and doing some experiments.
Potentially,
which I didn't know, and now I'm really excited to know that. I kind of want to go see what that's all about.
Well, I really want to send Dave to Mahorch's shed now.
Yeah,
I think we need to do this.
And I can just critique his tools and get uninvited.
Rome, what do you got?
Mine's a bit of a safe play, but I think that if you look at the economic climate of the cycling world, I think budgets are going to get tighter over the next 12 months. And I think there's going to be more and more stress to perform and to ensure a placement on teams and ensure a placement in World Tour and all that. So I think, desperate plays for results is going to become even more than what we've probably seen in the last 2 years. I think crazy stuff in the peloton might start to happen. I also think, we'll probably see, even for pro cycling, more issues of riders not getting paid and all that sort of crap that is so pro cycling.
I mean, I definitely think that another thing actually I was going to say before I decided to have like a nuclear take that people would be mad at was that my sort of prediction was that there would be a lot more labor activism in the peloton this year for several reasons. One is because, like you said, we're entering a recession and there's going to be more and more issues of payment and budget shrinking. Two, the relegation battle again is like another thing that's going to really contribute to stress in the peloton. Three, as the Tour de France every year gets like hotter and hotter, and last year everyone's nerves seemed really frayed in terms of like the actual weather being so horrible and so hot. And I think that this is going to become a more and more pressing issue. And then finally, there's a lot of these places where there are sort of, I guess you could say, undemocratic countries sponsoring cycling. those countries are also seeing a period of great instability because of the war in Ukraine. And so, like, I don't know if you guys saw the, I think Chris Marshall Ball had an article in Cycling Weekly about how the UAE might face sanctions for its continued business with Russia. Astana, like, suffered earlier last year because of political unrest in that country, in Kazakhstan. So it's where we might be sort of seeing cycling reach levels of the political that we haven't seen in a really long time. And I, for one, think that's a good thing because it enables us to talk about subjects that are difficult.
And we will talk about them here for sure.
Kaylee, what's your prediction?
Nairo Quintana is going to come back and win the Tour de France.
Oh yeah. That's a good prediction. Right there, Kaylee.
With who?
Who's going to ride for?
Human powered horse, dude.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent.
He's going to leave Cav out to win in the final stage on the Champs-Élysées.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
I honestly thought he would go to Astana.
I still wouldn't count that out, actually. I don't know exactly how many slots Astana has left. I'd have to go count them up, but that could still happen. He's hinted a couple different times that he's going to be, again, we talked about this previously, some translation stuff, right? Well, he's going to be in the World Tour, whether that means he's going to be on a World Tour team or whether he's just going to be racing in the occasional World Tour race.
Or a mechanic.
Or a mechanic, Swanier, and a new Astana Swanier. No, that'll be Lopez. Yeah, you never know. You never know. Like I said, I explained my soft spot for Nairo previously, and so that's what I'm going for. All right. Well, before we wrap up the racing section of today's episode, Dane, you caught up with Ineos's young American Magnus Sheffield last week. What was kind of the highlight of that?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting the way he was talking about the environment over at Ineos, which is it's a fluctuating environment. I mean, the team has kind of changed identities a little bit in the past 2-3 years, having gone from being the Chris Froome, I mean, if you want to go back far enough, Wiggins, juggernaut winning Grand Tours to being whatever it is now with Pidcock. I mean, they just won Roubaix. It's a great team still, but in different ways. They still come up with a lot of wins. If you look at the rankings, they're still up near the top. And it's just doing so in different ways. And I kind of asked him about the environment. And in a couple of different ways, I asked him about that. And also just kind of what he expects for next year. And I think American fans can be pretty excited about Sheffield. It's been a little while since I feel like there's been a number of Americans that I've been this excited about. Sepquist having been at that kind of top level for a couple of years now, but now you've got guys like Sheffield who are kind of coming up and look very promising. Look, they might actually pull off some big wins. And we're in this period now where people aren't heaping the same amount of pressure on them maybe that they were on TJ Van Garderen a few years ago. And I think that helps as well. I'm excited about Sheffield, and I thought it was interesting that he, you know, talked about his place in this team, which, you know, when you go from being a guy who's riding not at the level of the World Tour to jumping up to the World Tour with Ineos at 20 years old, that's a big step. And I thought that was pretty cool, and that's kind of why I reached out to him. So yeah, here's a little bit of that chat.
Just a quick hot take about Americans. Two of my ex-teammates, firstly, Sean Quinn, who rides for EF. I think both him and Matty Riccitiello, who's just signed for Israel, are going to be extremely good, knowing their power numbers and having raced against them on training camp and in training numerous times. American fans have got an awful lot to be excited about.
And that's even better. It's better when you say it, because you can tell if you're listening, that's not an American person saying it. So it there's a lot more value, you know, to be gleaned from that. It's not just Homerism.
Oh, no, Joe's from Oklahoma. He just does the accent really well. All right, let's listen to Magnus.
Did you have any big surprises, you know, this just racing at the World Tour level, coming up from Rally and then going, you know, straight into the, you know, maybe the biggest team in the world?
Yeah, people, a lot of times there's this kind of preconceived notion of kind of like what the vibe is in this team, and it's people talk about it being very robotic or kind of cold, like a machine. But I'd say, like, the people that I've met and the relationships I've met and just, like, the team in general, like, I was just surprised just the first day I was in the environment within the team is just, like, how relaxed everyone is, how friendly, and just, like, the polar opposite of what people had told me
yeah.
In the past. past. And I don't know what it is that makes it like that.
You were talking about the vibe at INEOS, and I'm kind of curious about that too. To me, it seems like this is sort of a team in transition after so many years of, you know, the Grand Tour dominance with Froome, with Thomas, etc. Is the team trying to get younger, trying to focus on new things? Is it still sort of business as usual, where you kind of want to get back to being the Grand Tour dominant squad? Like, what is the team kind of talking about in terms of what it's planning for the future?
Yeah, so there were, I would say last year, like when I joined the team, there were a few other younger guys that joined, and I think that's just, I don't think it's the norm by any means, but I do think that teams are now feeling that if they're not investing in younger riders, they're afraid of missing out. I think also the core of this team is, yes, but yeah, I think the team still wants to focus on the Grand Tours, but I think they also now see the type of riders they have, and I think they see the opportunities we have within the Monuments and the Classics. So I think it's, the Grand Tours are still an objective, but I think the opportunities we have in these other races, the team also sees that as an importance as well.
Interesting stuff, as always, from Magnus. INEOS being less robotic than we all seem to think it is. I'm not sure I believe it. I feel like every time a rider tells me that, and then I hear about sort of the way that they actually operate, they're all a little bit more robotic than they'd like to perhaps admit, I would say.
I was pleased that he said it. You know, the cyclist got a problem with even acknowledging image problems. I mean, just the other day, Miguel Ángel López released a statement saying something along the lines of, I've never tested positive, which, come on, like, it's been 20 years. We don't need to keep saying that. You need to be at least aware that that's something that is out there and avoid saying it. Or, you know, zipping your lips, whatever. There's things that... So just being aware of cycling's image issues, I was pleased to see that a 20-year-old, I mean, kid, really, is aware that people know or think of INEOS as being robotic. So that's a step in the right direction, I think.
Agreed. All right, well, we're gonna wrap up the racing part of today's podcast, mostly because we're about to talk about internal routing on mountain bikes, and Joe, Kate, and Dane do not care in the slightest about what we're about to talk about. So we are going to thank them as a group for joining on today's episode. Joe, Kate, really, I very much appreciate it, and we'll have you back on. Obviously, you are placeholders now.
Yay!
And we're going to be kicking this podcast back off as soon as we get to the new year. So keep an ear out for those two. And thanks you both for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Merry Christmas.
Bye, y'all.
You too as well.
Thank you.
And Dane, see you, bud. We'll see you next year.
Do you appreciate it? Okay. I feel appreciated. Great. Thanks. Yeah. have a great chat.
All right, Dave Rome. It's just you and me. It's just you and me here to talk about internal mountain bike. Particularly brake hose routing is actually what we're talking about. So first of all, explain where this comes from, why we wanted to talk about this week.
I feel like you're angrier about it than I am, because I actually now own a mountain bike with this feature. But I mean, we've seen it happen on road bikes first, where the introduction of disc brakes and really electronic shifting allowed bike designers and manufacturers to start getting a little bit more creative with cleaning up the bike aesthetically. Initially it was an aerodynamic claim, really now it's an aesthetic thing. The brake lines are hidden often through the handlebar and through the stem, and then run through the center of the headset bearing, typically along the fork steerer tube, and then into the frame from there. And it's actually not so difficult to do with, hydraulic disc brakes, where the hose can be bent at really any angle without increasing friction. And it's even easier to do now that the two major drivetrain manufacturers have wireless or semi-wireless shifting, so you don't really have to worry about wires at that end. We're starting to see mountain bikes follow the trend. And it's much more questionable as to the benefit and the reasons why. Because on mountain bikes, you're much more likely to, say, break a handlebar, or to need to take your rear brake off, or at the very least need to take the suspension fork off for servicing. And this internal cable routing just seems to complicate things there. So yeah, for me personally, I recently built up a hardtail that has said feature. It's a factor hardtail. And I elected to go with SRAM axis shifting and a dropper on that bike because one, I'm fancy, and two, I like the cleanliness of it. But I'm very anti this idea as long as someone still is using cables on their bikes. So like a cable operated derailleur or a cable operated dropper. I think this system greatly confuses things. So yeah, for me at the moment, it's still a wireless shifting only benefit. And if you don't have wireless shifting, then best avoid said internal routing. But yeah, what brought this conversation on is Specialized Racing posted a teaser image of them in their wind tunnel testing a mountain biker. I don't know who the rider is. Do you know who that rider was?
I don't recall now.
It didn't look like Blevins, but they're wearing a time trial helmet.
With the face sock.
As you do on a mountain bike. But yeah, notably there's a one piece handlebar on this hardtail bike. And there's what appears to be SRAM's new rumored brakes, which point the brake hoses back toward the handlebar. And a bunch of pinching and zooming on the image makes it look like, kind of shows the brake hoses disappearing, but it does look like they're still external of the handlebar, but then they are disappearing into the frame. And yeah, it's questionable benefit because you still have your front brake hose flapping in the wind because that's the nature of suspension forks. So yeah, I don't know what to think about it, but I know there's a lot of hatred toward it.
Well, so I ran a poll on Instagram, on my Instagram. Mm. So the two options were our internal mountain bike lines. Option one, cool looking. Yes. Or option two, dumb, evil, and annoying. And dumb, evil, and annoying won 74% to 26%. So the people out there, although honestly, 26% is sort of higher for yes than I would have guessed. And actually isn't that far off of my own opinion here. My own opinion here is that, one, doing it for sort of aerodynamic gains feels very, I don't know, it feels very anti-mountain bike to me. But I'm very much in the sort of mountain bike, particularly cross-country racing camp, that is more excited about, for example, they're calling it a downcountry series here in the Western United States for next year. Four events put together, like there's one in Moab, for example. It's gonna be gnarly stuff, right? That's the cross-country I like. And so the sort of aerodynamic...
Basically Downeyville, but with new branding.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
And so aerodynamic mountain bikes just sort of hit me the wrong way, even though I'm sure they're slightly faster. If you're racing Leadville, I'm sure it's faster, right? But I just don't like it, and I will never pretend to like it. However, it looks cool. Mm. I genuinely think it looks nice. Like, it looks neat. It looks tidy. Same reasons why people like it on road bikes. And I can totally get that. And I think that where I come down on this is I'm kind of okay with it for the really top-end bikes where you're likely to have a professional mechanic and you're likely to have the funds to pay a professional mechanic to do these things properly and to take care of this bike for you. It's when this stuff starts to trickle down and it becomes the only option at lower price points, which is currently where we are in road bikes and even a lot of gravel bikes.
Yep.
That's when I start to have a problem with it, because then you're essentially saying, you know, instead of swapping a headset bearing being a 10-minute job that costs you a commensurate amount for a 10-minute job, it's now a 2-hour job.
Plus bar tape, plus brake hoses.
Plus all the parts. And you're talking about, you know, okay, you've spent $1,500 on your gravel bike. For some reason, it has internal lines all over the place. If you're spending $1,500 on a gravel bike, you know, you're probably, your budget is not infinite, right? And then you've got to spend $250 to get your headset bearing replaced, right? Yep. That's when I start to not like the direction things are going. And I understand why bike brands do it. Like, if people want to buy the clean-looking internal routed bike, then so be it. But it still hits me the wrong way.
Yeah. And it goes back to what I was saying, is that the internal routing makes sense if your shifting is wireless. if you've got electronic shifting, you're on a high-end bike. At that point, at least on a mountain bike, you've only got one brake hose to undo in order to change that headset bearing. And it doesn't really make... I mean, it's a little bit trickier, but like you can pull the fork out without a huge drama either. So it's fine. Like, I'm fine with it. And at that point, you don't have a large flappy hose that wraps around the bike that's waiting to be, you know, taken out by a brush or something like that. Like, it does tighten up the steering, the arc of that hose as well, so it doesn't have to go under as much flexion. There are benefits to it, but only when you've got really a really fancy drivetrain on that bike. I really hate this trend for lower end, as you say, where there's still mechanical pieces in the loop, and you're having, say, a derailleur housing that's probably going to go under a tighter bend than before, so it's going to have more friction, it's going to need replacing more frequently, it's going to be a pain in the ass when it does need replacing. So yeah, I'm anti it at the low end. I'm okay with it at the high end. But where I'm not okay with it, and this actually does scare me, and I'm sorry for people that are listening to this that really haven't thought about this yet, but if you look at the latest bikes from pretty much every manufacturer, the latest high-end bikes are now coming, these mountain bikes are now coming with one-piece cockpits, integrated handlebar and stem. The latest Trek Fuel EX, a trail bike, has a one-piece carbon handlebar and stem. Canyon have done it. Yeah, there's all sorts of brands that have done it. Trek as well. So yeah, it's... The issue there is that right now they're just doing it because it looks cool and it's a feature. The next iteration of that is going to work with the next iteration of brakes, which point the hoses back towards the handlebar, and they're going to run the hoses through that one-piece handlebar and cockpit and then into the frame. And then at that point, we've got all the things we hate about it, hate about those one-piece integrations where the hoses are running through the handlebar and stem. But magnified on a mountain bike, because you don't have adjustment of like your bar roll, which is quite important on a mountain bike for dialing in your fit. And yeah, you do have crashes more frequently on mountain bikes. And then at that point, you've got a much bigger service bill and a much more expensive part to replace than you ever did before. And then it goes back to the previous conversation that we had where bars are getting really stiff, and those one piece handlebar and stem, in theory, could be made more flexible, but the ones I've tried have actually been stiffer than two-piece.
Yeah, me too.
So, yeah, it's... Unfortunately, the industry is priming us right now for stuff we do not want to see. And it's just the way the trends are going, and these products will sell to people that don't really understand the negatives of them, but I would like my brake hoses to stay external for now.
Please. Please leave my brake hoses external.
At least external of the handlebar.
That's all I want. Yeah. That's all I want.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, don't put extra holes in my handlebars to route brake hoses through them. I'd just like my... Yeah, I'm quite happy with my brake hoses flapping outside of the handlebar.
I mean, if done well, they don't flap that much anyway, right? No. Like,
a zip tie can stop that said flapping.
Yeah. You've just made me sad, Dave.
So
sad over here.
So yeah, that's the crystal ball. 5 years from now, this is where we'll be. We've seen it on the road bike. We've seen it happen in gravel bikes. It's now happening in mountain bikes. And I'm not keen on it. And I apologize for what is about to come. I don't need to apologize. It's not my fault.
Our fault. We're doing everything we can to stop it. We're yelling into the internet void. Yeah. Telling them to stop. Stop, stop, stop. But again... For super high end bikes, fine. You know, if you've got a mechanic that's going to deal with it and is going to deal with, you know, trying four different bars to make sure that it's right, and fine. For the rest of us, no, thank you. Well, I think that's enough of our ranting for today.
Yeah,
we wanted to warn you all out there that this is coming, and also to kind of, I don't know, a little wink and a nod and a hint toward the fact that we like mountain bikes and we will occasionally talk about them here. And the placeholders is not a mountain bike free zone for sure, because we think a lot of you out there probably ride a bit of mountain bikes as well. It's not going to be the focus of many episodes, but we like mountain bikes, so we will occasionally talk about them. And I think you can expect more on that front going forward.
And if you have no interest in mountain bikes, then I'd still say it's worth paying attention to, because what happens in mountain biking does have influence on what happens in road cycling, as we saw with Mahorik and the dropper post, or Pidcock dominating, or Matthew van der Poel taking some time off from the road season to go dominate the mountain bike world. There's a lot of crossover these days, and if you open your eyes to the other disciplines, you'll be better off for it.
Agreed. Plus, if you ride mountain bikes, you'd be a better road rider. No question.
That's true.
All right. That's it from us today. Thank you, everybody, for listening to all of the 2022 placeholder episodes. We are going to take next week off, because we're going to take a little break for the holidays and reset and, think about what to do in the new year. So we'll be back. I think it's like the 2nd. January 2nd is Monday. We'll be back on that Monday with episodes, into perpetuity at this point. We're very much enjoying ourselves. So thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. Those of you that have shared this, it is hugely appreciated. Obviously, we're starting from zero here, right? So everybody you can put this in front of is helpful to us and is more likely to basically mean that we can continue doing this.
Yep.
And to everybody who left a glowing review on iTunes and a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts, that is also appreciated. We've got a full 5 out of 5 on every single podcast thing that I've checked. So we love you for it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I previously asked for everyone to share it with a friend that had previously been made redundant in a job. I think for now, given it's Christmas, I would like you to interrupt your Christmas lunch, wherever you are having it, and just to play a segment of our podcast for all of the family and friends that you're with. That would be nice. So
they'll love it. They'll love it. Yeah. It'll really cut the ice on a tense
it really will.
Family
yeah.
Christmas.
Just, ting that glass and cut to it.